Dante Lamar Payne versus Commonwealth. Mr. Hutchins and Ms. Tyson.
This is my first time in this courtroom. I wasn't sure who went to which side.
I don't know that we've established that.
Yeah, with the jury box where it is, it's kind of confusing, I guess. You're good. Wherever is fine.
All right, Mr. Hutchins, you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
All right. We do not have any timing lights in this courtroom, and I'm keeping time on the bench. And you, when you get into your rebuttal, I'll just let you know that you can reserve or continue as you choose.
So I'll put my watch back on if you don't mind. I was going to use that.
Yeah, but my timer is going to trump your watch.
I appreciate that. I want to make sure.
He spent a lot of money on this timer. He wants to get his money worth out of it, sir.
We may begin.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Aaron Hutchins, and along with Aaron Ashwell, we represent Dante Lamar Payne. Your Honors, this case is all about eyewitness identification. Both parties agree on that. That issue is simply not in dispute. Today we're asking for three things. The first is that the court find error in the trial court's failure to issue a factors-based eyewitness identification jury instruction.
All right, let me stop you right there. The thrust of your argument on appeal is the cross-racial nature of the identification in this case, correct?
No, Your Honor. It's multifaceted. It goes not only to cross-racial, but it goes to the lighting conditions, the weapons focus, the other factors.
But to the extent that there's any cross-racial issue that's been raised on appeal, and it's certainly in your brief, the instruction itself doesn't address that at all. The proffered instruction that was, that's involved in this case doesn't even mention that, does it?
It does not, Your Honor. The proffered instruction.
I mean, it's a classic Telfair instruction.
It is a classic Telfair instruction, Your Honor. It does not mention cross-racial, but it enumerates factors for consideration, and cross-racial is one of those factors, and it also goes beyond that to discuss, we were also not allowed to have an expert in this case who could have provided evidence.
Well, that's a separate matter. I'm just trying to narrow, before we go off on a tangent here, it seems to me the jury instruction is the predominating issue here.
Correct.
Because you're certainly entitled to an instruction if there's evidence to support instruction of law, if it's an appropriate instruction of law. Now, having said that, let's see if I can narrow this focus. The United States Supreme Court in Perry versus New Hampshire said there's no due process implications involved in this sort of an instruction, essentially. Correct?
They did, but they also said one of the due process protections that is provided to criminal defendants is such an instruction.
No, I think they certainly cited with approval the instruction in Telfair, but they said it's not necessary to give it from the standpoint of honoring due process.
That's right, but they said it's a protection that's available to criminal defendants.
I get that, but I'm trying to set the... So we don't have I don't think we have a constitutional issue here. It seems to me what the United States Supreme Court has done is essentially leave it up to the various jurisdictions to decide whether or not they want to give such an instruction. Many of them have chosen to do so.
Yes, with the caveat that it is available and it can be a protection of due process if used.
And our Supreme Court has been ambivalent on the subject as well, as I understand it.
In Daniels, which is the decision in 2008, the Supreme Court says the defendant there wasn't asking us to adopt a broad instruction, to adopt a mandatory rule, so they haven't. They've left that question open, and part of what we're here today asking for is that this court close the door on that and say that we need eyewitness jury instructions in cases where...
Let me cut to the chase for me at least. Here's what troubles me about the direction you want us to go. Maybe you can answer my concerns. We typically instruct juries on issues of law. We don't... While it may or may not be error to instruct them on factual matters, for the most part, we reserve that to them. We let them use their common sense. And so, for example, when it comes to I think that many judges, this one would certainly be among them, are reluctant to micromanage how jurors weigh the facts. That's their entire prerogative, and juries as a group are magic things. They come together as individuals, and the whole becomes greater than the sum of the parts somehow. Having said all of that, The we're telling the jury essentially consider things like the lighting conditions, the ability of the identifier to observe, whether they have eyesight problems. These are all things that that are typically argued by counsel as matters weighing on whether an identification is more or less reliable, and it's the jury is ultimately the ones who decide where the credibility lies. So we're essentially telling them what they already know. And we're doing it in the form of an instruction, which is supposed to be an instruction of law, not an instruction of facts. So, you know, if you can't answer it, why are we going to start down this slippery slope? I know some jurisdictions have, but it seems to me if we're going to start micromanaging how we tell jurors to weigh the facts, that's never going to end at some point.
Juries are magical things, but they're also lay people. They don't understand the concept of eyewitness identification.
They certainly understand the concept of it's easier to see in the daylight than it is at night. They understand the concept that people with eye problems may be more suspect in their identification than people with 20/20 vision, things of that nature.
They do. They don't understand the concepts of weapon focus. They don't understand the concepts that go beyond perception versus an eyewitness's ability to recall. But jurors don't have this toolbox, right? They don't have it. They may have this common sense notion, but the arguments of counsel aren't what they're instructed on. The jury needs to be armed with the list of factors to consider when evaluating an eyewitness identification. Science teaches us that eyewitness identifications present all sorts of problems.
Mr. Hutchins, let me stop you there, because this is where I kind of depart from your argument. You've conceded that there's no constitutional requirement that this instruction be given, correct?
The Supreme Court has said so, yes, sir.
So when you talk about science and you cite a lot of studies in your brief, all of that certainly leads to the possibility that there is some type of identification deficiency in some people. That having been said, that seems to me to be a policy as to whether or not this kind of evidence justifies the granting of an instruction. And I've always thought that the branch of government that deals with policy is the General Assembly, not the judiciary. Why should we impose upon the judiciary a policy-based instruction?
It's not necessarily a policy-based instruction. It's an instruction that enables the jury to properly evaluate testimony. We've done it before. The Virginia Model Jury Instructions have a self, when we talked a lot about self-defense today, self-defense instruction talks about things of defendant's viewpoint, subjective, was it imminent danger,
but
what did he use necessary force?
You're asking us to accept the studies that you've cited. I'm sure there are other studies out there that contradict some of those findings. And the province of winnowing out what the best policy in this Commonwealth would be as to eyewitness identification is often left to agencies like the Crime Commission or, as I say, the General Assembly.
It is often left to those agencies, but this court should do it because it goes beyond a mere policy consideration. 30 years of research has shown that eyewitness identifications are inherently unreliable.
I bet I could find somebody that disagrees with that.
You may well can,
so,
but they would be
so
few and far. But I would
have to choose between experts, and that's
and you're
what
generalizing, and I think it's really unfair to generalize. There's no question that some identifications are unreliable. Even many are unreliable, but not all. I mean, and it depends. Opportunity to observe. How long, if I'm staring at you for 10 minutes, I'm more likely to be able to pick you out of a crowd later on as opposed to if I just get a fleeting glance. This is not something we need to tell a jury. It's something they already know. Now, you don't need an expert to come in and say that, identifications based at, that are done at night from a long distance away, are should be more suspicious or maybe at least less credible than one in broad daylight from 3 feet away. So, and as far as weapon focus is concerned, some people certainly focus on weapons, but my own experience, I've tried cases for many, many years, is that I've had witnesses who, when confronted with a weapon, focus on the individual because they don't want to look at the weapon, and as a result, their identification is pretty strong because they're able to describe in detail not only what the person looks like, but what they're wearing and that sort of thing.
And that's correct, but it depends, and it's a fact-by-fact analysis here. Looking at the facts of this case, the victim concedes that it was a very relatively short encounter. It was at night, under poor lighting conditions. There were two weapons, one a knife in his side and a gun pointing at his face. He testified that he focused on each of the weapons, could remember their defining characteristics, was not looking at the face of the defendants.
And all that I'm sure was argued to the jury by trial counsel.
It was. But the arguments of counsel are not a substitute from instructions of law from the court.
But they're not instructions of law. It's not the law that identifications are unreliable. It's not the law that, you know, that there are various factors that weigh, you know, to a greater or lesser extent. That's what juries do. That's what we tell them. Use your common sense. Use your ordinary everyday experience. Decide who is credible. We're not going to tell you who is credible. That's what I think what you want us to do is to let's present an expert who's going to say this witness is not credible, this maybe this one is, that sort of thing. And we don't typically get into that.
I think credibility and reliability are different things. What we're asking the court to do is focus on the reliability of eyewitness identifications, not the credibility of a witness. I mean, science teaches us that a witness could think he's telling the truth 100% of the time on an eyewitness case, and he may not be.
He may not be. But it's not for us to say that.
But the jury, if the jury doesn't have the factors-based instructions, they do not have the tools to properly evaluate the eyewitness testimony.
Are there any limits to when this instruction should be given in your view? I mean, if there are three witnesses, all of whom identify the defendant, do we still give the instruction?
Your Honor, I think if the case is only based upon the eyewitness identifications, this instruction needs to be given. For instance, in this case, there was no forensic evidence leaking.
But how many witnesses have to identify the defendant before the identification is inherently reliable?
I don't know the answer to that.
Isn't that a question we've got to answer? Let me ask you another question. Suppose I'm sure there's plenty of studies out there that say that people of my age have memory impairment at times.
I can take judicial notice of that. So,
so you know, if anybody over 60 should testify, do you get an expert or a jury instruction saying the older you get, the less likely you are to accurately recall what you observed?
If the evidence of the case supports it, I think an instruction should be given. That's the law. That's Dela Cruz. That's what this court has said in Boone. It's what the Supreme Court has said in Frey. If there's evidence to support such an instruction, if there's evidence to support the fact that...
But it's not an issue of law. Or maybe I'm missing something. You can point to a case that says it's a matter of law as to what juries consider in determining a witness credibility.
It's not necessarily an issue of law, but just as it's not an issue in law in self-defense of what the juries consider, we still instruct them on the factors to consider
in
their self-defense analysis.
For example, the fact that we view the jury is instructed to review the issue of self-defense from the subjective standpoint of the defendant. That's not an issue of fact. That is a matter of law. The law is that they are not to apply their conception of what whether they would it would be self-defense or not. They're to apply the issue at, from the defendant's standpoint as he or she perceived it. Because that is a purely a matter of law. But to suggest that, for example, that it's a matter of law that that the lighting conditions impact on the ability of a witness to perceive is just plain pure common sense, it seems to me.
But I disagree that it's pure common sense, because it goes beyond that. It's perception, it's reliability, it's ability to recall.
Point to a statute, point to a legal principle that would ordinarily justify a jury instruction that along the lines of you consider, you know, those things. I mean, Telfair, the feds have adopted policy decisions, Judge Petty referred to it, to go ahead and do that. And I don't, you know, given that there's no constitutional problem with it, there's certainly no problem with it. But to suggest that that we invade the province of the jury by telling them how particularly to view the facts and acting as if it were a matter of law, it seems to me, is misleading.
I don't think we're invading the providence of jury. I don't think we're telling them how to view the facts. I think what the instruction does and what all the states that have adopted it, and what they say is that it's not telling the jury how to view the facts. It's telling you these are the factors that impact an eyewitness identification. You can consider them. It says may consider. So you may consider these factors, and it just gives the juries an extra lens on which to view the eyewitness identifications. Need this lens.
You're getting into your rebuttal. I don't know if you want to reserve.
I'll reserve.
I do want to pose one thought to you that I'd like to have you answer when you stand up again. And this segues into your last assignment of error, the hiring of the expert witness. We don't have any evidence in this case to support the instruction, I think you'd concede, primarily because the expert witness wasn't appointed and you didn't have that opportunity to introduce the evidence. So what I want to ask of you is, if we were to agree with you about the hiring of the expert witness, what limitations would be put on that? Would that be available in every case in which there's eyewitness identification?
I'll address that.
Now you can save you time.
Thank you.
Ms. Tyson?
May it please the Court, I'm Virginia Tyson for the Commonwealth. I think it's important to understand what the issue before this Court is today, and that is whether the trial court in this case abused its discretion. And I think it's very interesting that the Court in this case recognized exactly what Daniel said and exactly what this Court said in Johnson, and that was that the Court had jurisdiction and could give an instruction like this in an appropriate case.
Well, nobody can object to it because the Commonwealth couldn't appeal that.
This is I'm sorry, what?
I said if the instruction were given, it'd be like a tree falling in the forest. There's no appeal from that.
Well, it wouldn't be an abuse of discretion then. But in any event, in this case, the court didn't blindly say, I'm not going to do it, I can't do it. The court understood that it had the option and said it's the other instructions cover these issues, and actually had some problems with the Telfair instruction because the court felt like it was limiting what the jury could consider. So I think that that's very important. The court did not abuse its discretion in this case.
Well, we have, I say we, the Supreme Court has required instructions relating to the credibility of witnesses. And I point specifically to the instruction that's required to be given, that you shall view the testimony of an accomplice with great care and caution. And that's as far as I know, a judicially created instruction on the credibility of that particular witness. Why shouldn't we take this and apply that same judicial discretion and create an instruction in this situation?
Well, and the accomplice instruction, and that instruction was discussed last weekend at the Model Jury Instruction Committee meeting. There was a case that came out this year from the Supreme Court about accomplice, and who's an accomplice, and can one accomplice corroborate another one? So there is, as a matter of law, a matter of case law with regard to accomplices. And because,
well, that's what they're asking for, is that we create some case law in this way as well.
Suppose we apply the same analysis and say the uncorroborated testimony of a single witness requires the giving of this particular instruction. That would simply be taking that accomplice instruction to another level.
And Your Honor, I think that would be an improper decision from any court, but I think after Daniels, this court cannot do that. I disagree with Mr. Houchins that the Supreme Court left this issue open. I think the Supreme Court in Daniels said, we recognize that a number of states have had these mandatory instructions, and we're not one of those states. We find, as many states still do, that this is a matter for the trial court's discretion. We're not prohibiting a trial judge from giving this instruction in the proper case. However, in Daniels, the Supreme Court also said, a trial court does not abuse its discretion if the other instructions adequately cover the issue. And let me point out, as I did in my brief, that not only did the court in this case give all of the instructions that were given in Daniels, but there's a relatively new instruction that we have had as a model only for a few years, and it was given as number 4 in this case. And that is, the court instructs the jury that one of the disputed issues in this case is the identification of the defendant as the person who committed the offenses charged in the indictment. The Commonwealth has the burden of proving the issue beyond a reasonable doubt. So they have the very general credibility, burden of proof, presumption of innocence, but also pointed out in this case, because it was relevant in this case, that identification is a disputed issue. The Commonwealth has the burden beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, I understand defense counsel's point that argument is not an instruction and that argument is not evidence. And the jury is instructed that what the lawyers say in summation and opening is not evidence. But there was an off... I'm sorry.
I was going to ask, because we haven't addressed it yet, but in terms of an expert coming in and testifying along these lines. Now, it seems to me, this is not the case here, but let me pose a hypothetical to you and see, because I'd like to know what the Commonwealth's view would be on something like this. But if we were to have, say, a single witness identification, and let's say there was some evidence in the record that this particular individual, for whatever reason, because of their upbringing, because of some cultural situation, had an inordinate fear of individuals of a particular race, that might, and an expert was proffered to the trial court. Forget Ake for a second. You know, we don't have any issue about taxpayers paying for it. Let's assume that the defense purported to offer wanted to offer an expert who would testify that they have examined the witness, or at least their medical records or whatever, and wanted to offer a particularized opinion as to the reliability of that particular witness based on the impact of this cultural situation or whatever it might be, this irrational fear, and that might have a severe impact and render to some lesser extent reliable their identification. Would it be error for the court to admit something like that, as opposed to just a generalized, you know, eyewitness identification, you know, is often unreliable?
I think that gets very close, and I think that it would cross the line in having testimony about witness credibility, which of course is not permitted. And I understand that there may be a line between reliability and credibility, but I think that what that... The hypothetical, that expert would be saying this witness is not credible on this issue, and that would be invading the province of
the jury. If they actually said that, I think you're right. But if they simply said no, that makes a huge difference in whether there's a disproportionate impact because of this bias.
Right, and I think that my response would be. Given where we are in the law right now, that cross-examination would be sufficient, and if there was some other evidence, the witness could be cross-examined.
I guess what I hear your response is essentially you can conceive of no circumstances where an expert under it on any aspect of identification would ever be proper.
And I hate to speak in those, but standing here at this moment and thinking about it here before this court, I would think that would get very, very close and cross the line into witness credibility. And I know that some courts permit these eyewitness experts. I also know that there's some jurisdictions in the literature that do not. And then I also think that there is that matter of discretion. And
before that were to be admitted, though, wouldn't you be required to have some type of hearing to determine whether that is reliable scientific evidence?
Well, it's sort of a Daubert situation.
I think
that...
I didn't want
that,
to use the word.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
We don't use that word.
I'm sorry. Okay, well, but in federal habeas land, we still use Daubert. I'm sorry.
That's a requirement before any new scientific evidence is admitted.
Well, and I will say, as I'm also standing up here thinking about it maybe for the first time, I think it was Curry the Curry case from this court and 30 Virginia App, that actually an expert testified to some things and not others, and this court said that was okay. So I guess that a court has at least recognized that there is the possibility for some expert testimony in this area.
I think we might agree that generalized, you know, simply saying, generally speaking, certain things are inherently unreliable might invade the province of the jury. But where you have a particular individual with a particular disability, so to speak, or condition or whatever that impacts, it seems to me there could be, at least in the abstract, the possibility of
yes, there were some distinctions. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Certainly there were some distinctions in the Curry case about what was permitted and what was not. And I will say that first of all, I want to respond to a couple of arguments from opposing counsel that, yes, eyewitness identification was absolutely critical in this case. It was a central issue. It was not the only evidence in this case. There was jail telephone conversation where the defendant admits that in almost the Perry Mason moment of this case, the victim picks out the defendant as he's sitting in the audience at the preliminary hearing of the co-defendant and then is heard on the telephone saying that the victim had recognized him. And the other caller responds to that. But also there is a piece of circumstantial evidence in the case that the defendant in this case is the one who placed the ad in the first place. So whereas I am certainly not disputing that eyewitness testimony is critical and important, it is not the only evidence in the case.
And that would probably be sufficient corroboration if we were talking about accomplice testimony to keep out that instruction.
It may be. Your Honor, I don't think the victim admitted that the lighting was bad, and certainly Officer Musser didn't think that the lighting was bad. I think that he was asked that question, and he was thoroughly cross-examined, which I suppose is the next argument that I want to make, because I think it applies to both the instructions and the expert issue. And that is, in this case, the defense, although he did not have an expert, he asked for an expert for $8,000, and the court said, I'm not going to give you the money, but if you get an expert, come back, and I'll deal with it then. So there was no expert testimony. That is true. There was no instruction specifically about eyewitness identification. That is true. But the jury was constantly focused in this case on the eyewitness identification, the conditions, the factors. In fact, the defendant, even in summation, used the very words that this witness had weapons focus. There was no objection to that. And as I mentioned a moment ago, while summation, while argument, is not evidence and juries are so instructed, defense counsel was able, through cross-examination, through opening statement, through summation, to bring to the jury's attention these very issues. And no one objected. No one objected and said, there's no evidence to support that. He was permitted to make the argument. He certainly cross-examined the witnesses extensively about the timing and the weapon and the lighting conditions and the fact that this was the first time that the victim had ever met the people who were involved. Those very factors that were in the instructions that he proffered, there was cross-examination and there was argument presented. And so I think that some of the cases that discuss whether or not, some of the cases from other jurisdictions that discuss whether these instructions should be given, do note that there is cross-examination and there is summation. I think Perry versus New Hampshire, although that case mentions as one of the safeguards in the adversarial system is the possibility of a specific instruction, also mentions the burden of proof. It also mentions effective assistance of counsel in cross-examining the witness. The standard of admissibility of evidence with probative must outweigh prejudice. So at every turn, voir dire, opening, cross-examination, and summation, the jury's attention was brought to the issue without objection. And the judge in this case given all of the evidence that we had, did not abuse his discretion not giving the instruction. The evidence from the witness in this case was, as I mentioned before, the Perry Mason moment. This was not the very typical case. He picked out the defendant, not when the defendant was sitting at counsel table, but when he actually was sitting in the audience of a preliminary hearing of another person.
Was there any particularized need expressed to the court for the expert? Was there sufficient particularized need?
There was not, and the court so found. And I will say that the judge at the hearing, during the hearing, there was discussion that an expert could not testify about the credibility of a witness. And I have page 64 of the appendix written here that the purpose of the expert would be for generalized education, factors that affect eyewitness identification, and how they are present in this case. The court at the hearing noted its concern that the kind of testimony would invade the province of the jury, but also noted that the court did not find a particularized need. And I think that's true. Given what was proffered, there was not a specific proffer of what Dr. Schomer, I believe his name was, would testify to, but there was mention to the court that this particular doctor was an expert in eyewitness identification and, I think, cross-racial identification. But given the ability to cross-examine, the ability to argue to the jury, there was not a particularized need shown for the expert in this case. And that's the reason we cited the Morva case in our brief, that in looking at the denial of funding for an expert, which of course is an abuse of discretion standard, that the question is, was there an adequate opportunity to present the claims, to adequately present those? And they really were in this case. And the court, of course, must make that decision on the front end. And given what was presented at the hearing, the court did not abuse its discretion in determining not to allocate those funds for the expert. So I would be happy to touch on the other issue that was not addressed, the admissibility of the email, if the court has any questions.
I think you're out of time.
If not, then I'm not going to do it. I would urge this court to please affirm.
No, thank you very much. How do we tell the trial courts when to allow funding for an eyewitness expert and when it's not required?
Right. I think in this case we needed funding because there was no other. The eyewitness testimony was the only evidence. What
You say that, but now the Attorney General has just argued that there was other evidence that was corroborating of that eyewitness identification.
The lead detective in this case testified that she didn't think that the defendant had committed this crime. When the identification occurs at the preliminary hearing of Dustin Payne, his co-defendant and cousin, Mr. Vi had already been shown the photo lineup, which did not contain the lookalike suspect, but only contained my client's photo. He'd already seen my client. So he points to the back, turns, points to the back, and is pointing at the client in what the Attorney General calls the Perry Mason moment. The Attorney General then wants to say, well, Mr. Payne said he recognized me. Well, Your Honor, Mr. Payne is 19 years old. He's indigent. That's how he speaks. I mean, it'd be like saying somebody pointed me out. I think he just didn't know another word.
Isn't it?
Excuse me?
That's for the jury to determine, isn't it?
It is for the jury to determine what the context of that statement.
It would seem to me, as I pointed out, that the fact that he placed the ad in the first place would have been sufficient corroboration to keep out the co-defendant, the accomplice, credibility instruction. I mean, it doesn't take a lot of corroboration. So even if we go down the path you suggest, at some point we're going to have to say, no, there's sufficient corroboration here that you're not entitled to an expert.
Well, speaking to the ad was placed. It was used. He used his cousin's number. Mr. Payne testified that it was placed the ad for his cousin. That predated the identification and the crime. And so, this case was about the identification once it took place. If he placed the ad, that has no bearing on whether he was actually there at the crime scene. It was just the mechanism which the Commonwealth argues lured Mr. Vi there, but it doesn't necessarily place Mr. Payne at the crime scene. I think it's especially true in a case, we need an expert in this case, because we have a situation where we have a suspect who's conceived by the lead investigator to look like Mr. Payne. Booney or Mark Rosser was the individual.
Well, we would have to reach the issue of whether you would be entitled to admit any expert testimony on this point before you even get to whether you'd be entitled to a court-appointed expert, it seems to me. I mean, obviously, if it's not, if it wouldn't be proper to admit generalized expert testimony, which is what was proffered here, then it certainly wouldn't be improper to not expend taxpayer funds on it.
I think when you look at the hearing transcript from that hearing on the expert assistance, I think we need to look beyond that and look at the motion, which was filed in the memorandum of support, which deals with what the expert would have testified to and the need for the expert, the particularized need that we articulated there, as well as at the hearing. I think it goes beyond a generalized expert testimony, because in this case, we have specific things which are scientifically shown to affect memory, to affect eyewitness identifications, to affect an ability to recall, which affect confidence building. These are things that are present in this case. There's a cross-racial ID. There are shown multiple photo lineups. There are weapons. There are two weapons here.
Mr. Hutchins, you're out of time. If you want to bring this to conclusion, I'll give you a moment to do so.
Thank you, Your Honor. As far as the other points, we would adopt the arguments on our brief and the brief filed by the Virginia Criminal Defense Association, the amicus brief filed there, Your Honor. We would ask that you remand this case for a new trial and a fair trial. Thank you.
Thank you very much.